Welcome to the deep dive. This is the place where we try to take all the noise, the fire hose of news, and really just distill it down for you. We want to give you a truly comprehensive, exhaustive look at what's shaping our world. I'm Alex Vanderbilt.
And I'm Sam Astor. And our job today is to really synthesize this incredible source material. We're going to slice through that sheer volume of information so you don't just know what's happening, but you really get the why behind it, the strategic moves, the financial risks, and all those surprising links between stories that, on the surface, seem totally unrelated.
Absolutely. Our mission is to cut across everything from global conflicts and some really high-stakes political maneuvering to these unprecedented corporate legal dramas, and even, believe it or not, the psychology behind your holiday shopping. And the title of today's deep dive is The Wall Street Journal for Saturday, December 20th, 2025.
So let's jump right in.
Let's do it. We have to start with the critical global challenges, and that means a massive escalation in the Middle East. The U.S. military just executed a huge retaliation in Syria. It's being called Hawkeye Strike, and it followed a pretty deadly ambush. So, okay, let's unpack this show of force.
Well, the fascinating thing here isn't just the scale, though the scale is huge. It's how targeted the response was. The U.S. carried out this large-scale attack on Islamic State targets, specifically in central Syria. This was not, a minor skirmish. We're talking about more than 70 targets hit by a really coordinated high-tech force.
Can you give us a sense of the hardware involved? What are we looking at here?
We saw US F-15E and A-10 warplanes, which are, classic for this kind of work, but also Apache attack helicopters and HIMARS rockets. They delivered over 100 precision-guided munitions, and critically, Jordanian F-16s were involved, too.
So it was a coalition effort.
Exactly, and that signals a lot politically. But the sheer size of this retaliation, it makes it the largest U.S. attack against Islamic State in Syria since the fall of former President Bashar al-Assad late last year.
And the trigger for all of this, for a Hawkeye strike, it was that ambush on December 13th.
That's right. The ambush killed three Americans, two soldiers from the Iowa National Guard, and one civilian interpreter. Three Syrians were also killed or injured, and the operation was explicitly named Hawkeye Strike to honor those Iowa soldiers.
Right, the Hawkeye State.
It directly links the military action back to the human cost of that attack.
And this all happened at a really fragile moment, didn't it? U.S. policy in the region has been shifting. Mm-hmm. We've actually been trying to build cooperation with the new Syrian leadership.
Exactly. And that is the crucial diplomatic context that makes this so complicated. The ambush happened near Palmyra, and it wasn't just a random patrol. It was during a meeting between a local U.S. commander and an official from the Syrian Interior Ministry. So this attack directly targeted and fundamentally disrupted this growing counterterrorism cooperation between the U.S. and the new Syrian president, Ahmed al-Sharaa.
And the Trump administration has been actively trying to, ease Syria's path to stability. They even removed the CSIRT sanctions.
That is vital context. You're absolutely right. Removing those debilitating CSIRT sanctions was a huge diplomatic gesture. It was all aimed at helping this new government get on its feet. So now we're in this position where we're fighting ISIS to stabilize a government that we are now actively cooperating with.
A government that is itself still struggling with its own internal hardliners.
Precisely. And the blame game has already started. The Trump administration is pointing the finger squarely at Islamic State. But Syrian authorities have suggested it might have been an inside job carried out by a security force member who is about to be fired for extremist views. So the situation on the ground is just incredibly murky.
So even with all these changes, the threat from ISIS is still a major destabilizing force there.
Oh, absolutely. There was a Pentagon Inspector General report back in June that flagged this very thing. It cited the military coalition, saying that the number one goal of ISIS right now is to destabilize the new Syrian government. This massive military response just confirms that they are still very active and very capable in central Syria. And remember, the U.S. still has about 1,000 troops in the country trying to manage this.
That instability.
Yeah.
That struggle with traditional state structures. It brings us perfectly to this next story. We're talking about high stakes, truly unconventional diplomacy, where the rules seem to be getting rewritten not by diplomats, but by, of all things, Gulf partners. Mm. We have to discuss the absolutely extraordinary diplomatic rise of Steve Witkoff.
This story is, it's a perfect illustration of the Trump administration's preference for personal, transactional relationships over any kind of established protocol. Witkoff is a billionaire real estate developer, a longtime golfing partner of the president. He gets appointed special envoy to the Middle East, and almost immediately she's granted access that's usually reserved for, you know, top-tier intelligence officers or career foreign service people.
And this wasn't just some standard meet and greet. This was, it feels like, a strategic move by Moscow to sort of stress test the entire U.S. foreign policy machine.
That's a great way to put it. Witkoff gets an invitation from Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia, but that message was brokered by Kirill Dmitriev, who's the head of Russia's sovereign wealth fund. He's a key Kremlin moneyman. And the message is, Vladimir Putin wants to meet you. And the terms were specifically designed to bypass that traditional structure.
What were the terms? What did they demand?
They were very strict and very revealing. Witkoff was told to come alone. No CIA handlers, no State Department diplomats, and crucially, no American interpreter.
Wow. No interpreter.
Right. And that instantly signals that Putin wants to engage in pure personal transactional deal-making. He wants it free from the standard guardrails and, you know, the documentation that comes with professional diplomacy.
And to get this meeting, Putin offered a gesture of good faith. It involved releasing an American prisoner. Right.
Yes. The whole deal hinged on an American prisoner named Mark Fogel. Fogel was a high school history teacher. He was serving an incredibly harsh 14-year sentence in Rybinsk for possessing medically prescribed cannabis. Putin basically offered to consider releasing him in exchange for this private meeting with Witkoff.
That's a pretty stark trade. A private, unconventional meeting with a real estate developer for the freedom of an American citizen. So what happened?
Witkoff went. He was met by Dmitriev at the airport in Moscow, hosted by Putin for 3 hours, and he had to endure this long lecture on Russia's 1,000-year history. But importantly, the meeting produced the result they wanted. Fogel was transported by the FSB, released to Witkoff, and they flew home together through a snowstorm. The president was reportedly thrilled, calling Witkoff a killer dealmaker.
So why Witkoff? Why him? Why not a seasoned diplomat like, say, the former envoy Keith Kellogg?
Well, that's the key. Putin's team saw Kellogg as potentially hostile, specifically because of his daughter's charity work in Ukraine. That was a major red flag for Moscow. They are actively looking for people who see the world through a purely transactional, almost mercantile lens. Witkoff himself says he's a dealmaker, not a diplomat. He's focused on understanding what the other guy needs and giving them political space to get the deal done.
And this approach, it involves Jared Kushner, who's reportedly been pitching in on everything from Russia's borders to tearing down sanctions. It completely blurs the line between high statecraft and international business.
And that's where the serious concern comes in. Critics are worried that this is all just an elaborate deception by Putin, that the former KGB officer is just mirroring Trump's own values loyalty, deal-making back at him to string him along and get concessions. The fear is that this kind of structure, which has basically none of the traditional diplomatic checks and balances,
the things designed to prevent misunderstandings between nuclear powers.
Exactly. It leaves our longtime allies in Europe feeling completely exposed and out of the loop.
And speaking of Kushner and Witkoff, they've been working on a vision for rebuilding Gaza that is so ambitious, it honestly reads like a concept drawing for a new city in the Gulf, Project Sunrise.
It is truly audacious. It's all laid out in this 32-page draft proposal. The vision is to completely convert the devastated Gaza enclave into a futuristic coastal destination. They're talking beachside luxury resorts, a high-speed rail system, AI-optimized smart grids. It's a total reimagining.
Luxury resorts in Gaza. The scale of that transformation is just staggering to think about.
Yeah.
What's the price tag on something like that?
The project is projected to cost about $112.1 billion over 10 years. And the proposal suggests that the U.S. would act as the financial anchor, supporting nearly $60 billion of that total through grants and debt guarantees. The hope is that a transformed, prosperous Gaza could eventually fund its own future and pay down that debt.
But this can't happen overnight. I mean, what does the roadmap even look like?
It's a 20-plus year timeline, and the initial phases are they're grim but necessary. First, you have to remove all the rubble, the destroyed buildings, the unexploded ordnance, and dismantle all the Hamas tunnels. Only then can you move to temporary shelters and field hospitals. And after that, you get to the permanent construction of housing, schools, medical facilities. That glitzy Riviera is a very, very long-term goal.
And the vision even includes creating a totally new high-tech city called New Rafah.
Correct. The plan sees New Rafah as the new seat of governance. It would be home to over 500,000 residents with more than 100,000 new housing units. The long-run vision is based on monetizing 70% of Gaza's coastline by year 10, and they estimate over $55 billion in investment returns from this new coastal hub.
It sounds incredible on paper. But the biggest hurdle, the elephant in the room, is the immediate security situation.
The skepticism on this is overwhelming among U.S. officials and experts. The plan has an absolute prerequisite. Hamas must disarm first. And as one senior fellow put it very bluntly, nothing happens until Hamas disarms. Hamas will not disarm, so nothing will happen. The core challenge is whether the U.S. can convince donor nations, you know, the Gulf Kingdoms, Egypt, to actually finance this massive transformation in what is still a very dangerous post-war environment.
The sheer scale of the financing needed for that kind of geopolitical project. It brings us perfectly to Europe, where financial resolve seems to be fracturing, specifically around funding the war in Ukraine.
This is a direct parallel to the kind of unconventional moves we were just talking about. Europe is showing a pretty alarming lack of resolve when faced with Russian threats. Now, EU leaders did approve a significant loan to Ukraine, $105 billion, interest-free. It covers about two-thirds of their budget and military costs over 2 years. And the key detail is that Kyiv only has to repay this loan after Russia pays reparations.
The real financial drama was Europe's failure to use Russia's own frozen assets to fund the war effort. I mean, that would have been some serious poetic justice.
And that's the crux of the failure. Europe failed in its bid to impound Russia's frozen sovereign assets, which are estimated at about $250 billion. And two-thirds of those assets are held in Belgium at a place called Euroclear, which is the global settlement house.
So why did they back down? It seems like such a massive, logical source of financing.
It came down to fear. Specifically, financial fear and the threat of retaliation. The Belgian Prime Minister, Bart De Wever, he strongly opposed seizing the assets. He was afraid a successful legal challenge by Russia could trigger a financial crisis for his country, and Moscow threatened severe legal and financial retaliation against Belgium and De Wever personally. On top of that, Putin warned that seizing the assets would cause an erosion of trust in the entire EU as a safe place for financial assets.
So the political fear of Russian retribution was ultimately more powerful than the financial and, frankly, moral desire to fund Ukraine by directly punishing Moscow.
That's the real insight here. Instead of using that $250 billion in Russian assets as collateral, which was the original plan, EU taxpayers are now on the hook for the costs of the joint European bond used to fund this loan. Those vast frozen assets will likely just sit there untouched until the war ends. It really reinforces this idea that Europe struggles to act decisively when it's faced with Russian intimidation.
That hesitation, though, it contrasts so sharply with Germany. They're making this massive aggressive pivot toward rearmament and industrial revitalization. They've pledged more than $500 billion to defense.
This is a monumental shift. It's fundamentally changing the German economy. They've pledged to spend more than $500 billion on defense over the next decade. That will nearly triple their annual military spending to about $190 billion by 2029. And it's driven by geopolitical necessity, of course, but also by some serious domestic economic pressure.
How did that domestic pressure play into it?
Well, German manufacturers are facing economic stagnation. Their exports are falling, especially to the U.S. and China. So defense spending, which is backed by massive guaranteed government money and is protected from low-cost competition, has suddenly become a profoundly attractive new economic sector. Companies are just racing to reinvent themselves as military vendors. The main trade body for the German defense sector has seen its membership nearly double in just the past year. It's pulling in all these traditionally civilian companies, especially from the auto and industrial machinery sectors.
Can you give us some striking examples of this retooling?
Oh, yeah. We're seeing railcar factories being repurposed to build military vehicles. A printing machine maker, Heidelberger Druckmaschinen, a company you'd associate with, you know, old school industrial output, is setting up a new defense business. They're focusing on autonomous ground vehicles and energy systems, aiming for 100 million euros in annual revenue, and they're just using their existing engineers. Even more dramatically, an automotive supplier, Schaeffler, partnered with a defense startup called Helsing to scale up drone production. They're targeting 10,000 to 20,000 drones a year, with a surge capacity of up to 100,000 in a crisis.
That kind of capital injection and rapid retooling is impressive. But does this sudden military focus pose any long-term risks for the broader German economy?
Economists are definitely pointing to some significant structural downsides. For one, the export potential is limited, China is off limits, and the U.S. has a very strict Buy American strategy for its defense needs. And more fundamentally, military investment is often less useful for the wider economy than, say, infrastructure spending. Weapons tend to be stored or destroyed, not used productively to generate more economic activity. But, you know, the proponents are hoping that this massive capital investment will drive productivity and maybe spark new tech startups, kind of like how early U.S. government investment helped build Silicon Valley.
That shift brings us right back across the Atlantic to U.S. defense policy. The Navy is also looking to rapidly modernize its fleet. They've announced a new class of frigates as part of the president's envisioned Golden Fleet.
And the key insight here is the move away from complexity and toward proven, repeatable designs. The Navy announced this new frigate class will be built by HII's Ingalls Shipbuilding, and it's going to be based on the Coast Guard's highly successful, proven, Legend-class national security cutter.
And this decision is a direct response to the massive failure of the previous program, the Constellation-class frigate.
Oh, absolutely. The Constellation program, which was approved in the first term, it was canceled last month after years of delays and billions of dollars spent. It was supposed to be 85% common with its Franco-Italian counterpart, but because of constant design changes from the Navy, it ended up being only 15% common.
So the U.S. effectively threw away $2 billion on that.
They did. So the Navy's new priority is speed and reliability. They want to get the first new ship in the water by 2028 to address a critical capacity shortage. I mean, their current small surface combatant inventory is only a third of what the Pentagon says they need.
So the goal is quantity and capability over some bespoke, overly complex design. But American shipbuilders are notoriously struggling with production bottlenecks, supply chains, labor shortages. And that remains the single greatest challenge to this whole Golden Fleet vision. American shipbuilders are dealing with worker shortages and aging facilities. HII is investing $1 billion in infrastructure, and they're even exploring a joint venture with an international partner to significantly expand their capacity, maybe even create a second frigate shipyard. Navy officials are stressing that speed matters immensely here. They need these more capable frigates to protect logistics lines so that the high-end destroyers can focus purely on high-end fights with adversaries like China.
And staying on that theme of rapid procurement, the irony here is just incredible. The agency that was founded by Elon Musk to cut waste is now being used to fast-track spending. We're talking about the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, pivoting to a massive drone procurement program.
The irony is unavoidable, isn't it? DOGE, the cost-cutting agency formerly run by Musk, now has this key acquisition mission called the Drone Dominance Program. Its new purpose is to buy thousands of small one-way attack unmanned aerial systems, UAS, for the U.S. military.
What's the strategic goal there?
Well, the Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth, assigned DOGE this mission specifically to scale up the U.S. industrial base and urgently catch up to other countries. He cited Ukraine and conflicts in the Middle East where these small, cheap drones are being used in huge numbers on the modern battlefield.
And the key to their mission is to get around the notorious Pentagon bureaucracy.
Precisely. The effort is being led by Owen West, and he's using $1.1 billion that Congress appropriated for quick procurement through competition. It's specifically designed to bypass the Department of Defense's notoriously slow and cumbersome acquisition system. The timeline is aggressive. They want to get drones to military units by 2027. They've already invited 25 vendors to an event in February where operators will test systems and choose up to a dozen companies for contracts to supply at least 1,000 drones deliverable within 5 months. DOGE is being used because its brand is cost reduction, and they're hoping competition will drive down the cost of these systems.
All right, let's switch gears to public health. The push by Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to alter the U.S. childhood vaccination schedule, it seems to be gaining some serious momentum. What exactly is he proposing, and why is Denmark the model?
Kennedy is considering a dramatic alteration of the U.S. childhood vaccination schedule. He wants to align it more closely with Denmark's, which would mean significantly fewer recommended vaccines for American kids. This is a massive policy shift.
How significant is the difference between the U.S. schedule and the Danish one?
It's big. The U.S. currently recommends immunization against 18 different diseases. Denmark, on the other hand, recommends 10. So vaccines that could potentially be dropped for all U.S. children include those for chickenpox, rotavirus, meningococcal disease, and hepatitis A.
What's the argument being made for adopting a foreign country's schedule?
An acting FDA official suggested that the Danish schedule, by focusing only on what they're calling core childhood vaccines, might actually increase public trust in vaccines overall. The official noted that Denmark has a strong culture of debate and a less politicized discussion around the topic. Kennedy himself has said his goal is to provide Americans with gold standard science about vaccine efficacy and safety.
But using a smaller country with a nationalized healthcare system as the template for the entire United States seems to fly in the face of established public health principles.
And it is facing intense criticism from public health experts for exactly that reason. They argue that different countries face different specific disease risks. For example, the meningococcal subgroups that are dominant in Europe are different from the ones in the U.S. Furthermore, Denmark's nationalized system allows for universal tracking and rapid response in a way that the decentralized U.S. system just can't replicate. They're saying that outsourcing the job of protecting American children to a foreign schedule is scientifically unwarranted and actually increases disease risk.
And this move follows a pattern of controversial actions by the health secretary.
Yes, it does. Kennedy has already dropped the recommendations for COVID-19 vaccines for children and pregnant women. He ousted members of a key federal vaccine committee. And, controversially, he rewrote a government website to suggest that vaccines might cause autism, which flies in the face of decades of scientific consensus and drew fierce criticism from scientific organizations.
Another major policy area is drug affordability and the debate around controlled substances. Let's start with the Trump administration's new push on drug prices.
The administration has secured agreements with 9 major pharmaceutical companies. We're talking industry giants like Merck, GSK, Bristol-Myers, Squibb to lower U.S. drug prices for certain federal programs and patients. The core promise is that U.S. prices will become comparable to those charged in other wealthy countries, which have traditionally been much, much lower.
And what was the trade-off? What did the pharmaceutical industry get for agreeing to these price cuts?
In exchange for reducing prices for programs like Medicaid and this new TrumpRx.gov direct-to-patient service, the companies get 3 years of protection from potential new U.S. tariffs. It gives them policy certainty and stability, which they value highly.
Can you give us a tangible example of the savings we're talking about?
Certainly. Merck, for instance, agreed to offer its diabetes drugs Januvia and Janumet at a 70% discount off the current list price through that direct-to-patient program. Amgen will sell its migraine drug Aimovig for $299 a month, which is nearly 60% off the list price. On top of that, some companies are donating ingredients to a national stockpile. GSK is donating a 6-month supply of a respiratory inhaler, and Bristol-Myers is donating 6 months' worth of the critical blood thinner Eliquis and even providing Eliquis free to Medicaid programs.
That definitely sounds like tangible progress on affordability. Tied into policy, President Trump also ordered a major shift on how marijuana is classified.
That's the other big policy pivot. The order mandates rescheduling marijuana from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3 under the Controlled Substances Act. Schedule 1 is the most restrictive category. It's for drugs with no currently accepted medical use and a high potential for abuse. Moving it to Schedule 3 puts it in the same category as things like anabolic steroids, suggesting it has some legitimate medical uses and a moderate to low potential for dependence.
Okay, setting aside the medical debate for a second, what's the immediate financial impact of this rescheduling?
The immediate practical impact is significant financial relief for marijuana businesses. It allows sellers to deduct expenses from their taxes just like any other legitimate company. That's a deduction they were previously prohibited from taking because of the Schedule III classification. It's a huge deal for their bottom line.
But this move runs squarely into this growing public health controversy about the drug's modern potency.
That is the critical tension. Critics argue that the evidence for its medical benefits is weak, while at the same time, they're warning that cannabis today is 4 to 5 times more potent than it was in the 1990s. This drastically increases the risk of dependency. The CDC estimates that 3 in 10 users will develop an addiction.
And we are seeing real-world consequences from that increased potency.
Oh, absolutely. Hospitals are reporting more and more ER visits for severe symptoms, including hyperemesis, which is uncontrollable vomiting, and psychotic episodes, especially among younger users. And new studies are showing that young users have a 6-fold higher risk of heart attacks and a 4-fold greater risk of strokes. Critics are worried that rescheduling sends this dangerous normalizing message to vulnerable young people that marijuana is harmless, despite all this mounting evidence of long-term cognitive and physical harm.
Those policies are definitely dominating the national discussion.
Yeah.
Okay, let's pivot from that to the domestic side, where the release of the long-awaited Jeffrey Epstein files just dominated the headlines.
This was a mandated release. Congress voted overwhelmingly back in November to force the disclosure of records related to Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. That includes things like immunity deals and internal agency communications. And they had to override initial resistance from the Trump administration to get it done.
So what did the Justice Department actually release?
They released a batch of files. It included investigative files from the 2006 and 2018 cases and FBI materials related to Maxwell's prosecution and Epstein's death in 2019. This included, you know, some of the images we've seen, like former President Bill Clinton swimming with Maxwell and sitting on a plane with a redacted woman. It also had handwritten notes on Epstein's stationery and a photo of a logbook cover for trips to Epstein's Island.
But the reaction from lawmakers, who were the ones who demanded this transparency in the first place, was one of severe disappointment. They're suggesting this was far from a full disclosure.
They were severely critical. You had lawmakers from both parties, Democrats like Ted Lieu, Republicans like Thomas Massey, publicly slamming the release. They said it fell far short of what was demanded. They pointed to the extensive redactions, with some documents showing mostly redacted images of young women, and suggested it looked a lot more like a cover-up than genuine disclosure.
Were there any specific damning new revelations that managed to slip through all those redactions?
Yes. One key detail came from FBI interview notes that were conducted in 2019 with alleged victims. The note detailed Epstein allegedly asking for a girl's ID to ensure she was under 18 because, in his words, they had messed up by bringing more older girls. The documents also confirm the FBI has physical evidence, including CDs and DVDs with thumbnails of thousands of pictures from Epstein's life. The fight for true transparency is clearly far from over.
That push for transparency, it really reveals these deeper philosophical fractures within the MBI movement itself, particularly around the limits of free speech and how to deal with extremist voices.
This is a very public, very high-stakes clash. It happened at the annual Turning Point Conference in Phoenix, and it came just 3 months after the killing of the organization's founder, Charlie Kirk, who had famously championed open debate. And this clash just highlighted this profound tension in the conservative movement between two competing ideals.
And who was at the center of this conflict?
It was podcaster Ben Shapiro, who launched a very sharp attack on media star Tucker Carlson. He criticized him for conducting what Shapiro called softball interviews with fringe figures, specifically the white nationalist and Holocaust denier Nick Fuentes. Shapiro argued that platforming Fuentes was an act of moral imbecility.
And how did Carlson defend himself? I mean, how did he respond to the charge of giving oxygen to an extremist?
Carlson responded by arguing that Shapiro was betraying Kirk's founding principles by calling for deplatforming and denouncing people. Carlson maintained that the conservative movement, if it wants to avoid mimicking the cancel culture of the left, has to stand firm in its belief that people should be allowed to debate openly.
And this philosophical battle forced a lot of major conservative figures to pick a side.
It did. President Trump defended Carlson, saying, "You can't tell him who to interview." Even the Heritage Foundation, which is a central policy engine for the right, saw resignations after its president defended Carlson, though he later called his own defense a mistake. The core conflict is between the ideals of free speech absolutism and avoiding cancel culture versus the necessity of shunning voices that undermine party values. They cited past opposition to figures like David Duke. A lot of people feel the absence of Charlie Kirk, who is really skilled at navigating this broad and sometimes conflicting universe of influencers.
Shifting gears back to policy, Congress adjourned for the rest of the year without renewing the Enhanced Affordable Care Act subsidies. And that has immediately created a financial crisis for millions of Americans.
This is a devastating failure of political gridlock. It affects roughly 20 million Americans. Congress adjourned without renewing those enhanced ACA subsidies, which were central to that record-long government shutdown fight. The immediate result is that enrollees are facing sharp premium increases and profound uncertainty starting in January.
Can you give us a tangible example of the human and financial cost of this?
The story of Brandy Sutton, she's an office manager in Mississippi, is a really powerful illustration. Her monthly premium was set to jump from $126 to $600 starting in the new year. She relied on that coverage for critical things like treatment for a precancerous spot, and she felt she had no choice but to terminate her health insurance. And she said, "This move could literally kill me," which just highlights the life and death consequences of this legislative failure.
Why couldn't Congress reach a deal on this? I mean, it affects so many people.
It was pure political trench warfare. Democrats and some vulnerable House Republicans, they pushed for a 3-year extension of the subsidies. But most Republicans fundamentally oppose any extension of the subsidies. They see them as financially breathing life into a system they see as deeply flawed. Senate Majority Leader John Thune suggested that any compromise would have to include expanding the use of tax-advantaged health savings accounts. And that's an idea Democrats have so far rejected. The two sides are just miles apart.
And finally, on the political front, a significant retreat in New York,
yep.
The withdrawal of Rep. Elise Stefanik from the governor's race.
Right. Stefanik, who is a prominent Trump ally and one of the highest-ranking women in the Republican House leadership, announced she was suspending her campaign for New York governor. And she's also not seeking re-election to the House. She cited a desire to spend more time with her young son.
But the context here suggests there were some significant political struggles happening behind the scenes.
Oh, absolutely. She was polling 19 points behind the Democratic incumbent, Governor Kathy Hochul, in a heavily blue state. She was really struggling to gain traction. And her decision comes after a series of setbacks this year, including her nomination by the president to be U.S. ambassador to the U.N. being scratched because of concerns about the GOP's thin House majority that forced her to stay in Congress with a lesser leadership title. And she also recently publicly criticized House Speaker Mike Johnson as an ineffective leader, which just compounded her political turbulence.
Okay, moving now to corporate and market developments. We have to cover the monumental legal battle that just ended in favor of Elon Musk and Tesla. The Delaware Supreme Court has reversed the decision that rescinded his record-breaking pay package.
This is a staggering victory for Musk, and it's a huge moment for corporate governance in the United States. The Delaware Supreme Court reversed that 2024 Delaware Chancery Court decision that had effectively canceled Elon Musk's 2018 pay package. It ends the legal battle over compensation that soared in value to $139 billion.
Why did the Supreme Court overturn the initial ruling? The first one found the approval process was tainted.
The court's unsigned opinion argued that rescission, the act of just unmaking an agreement, is an extreme remedy that should only be granted when it's clearly warranted. The Supreme Court essentially felt the lower court's ruling would have unfairly deprived Musk of compensation for several years of work, during which Tesla met all of these incredibly ambitious performance milestones.
Wait a second, though. If the shareholder who sued, Richard Tornetta, if he argued the approval process lacked transparency and the directors were beholden to Musk, is the court saying that those factors just don't matter when the company performs so spectacularly?
That is the tension right there. The shareholder argued the board was conflicted, that it lacked independence. The court, however, seemed to prioritize the outcome. The original package was valued at $2.3 billion initially, and it was all contingent on performance. Because Tesla met those targets and the stock went through the roof, the package swelled to $139 billion. That sum is, by the way, more than the combined compensation of every other S&P 500 CEO over the past decade.
Wow.
So the court seems to be saying the reward should match the results.
What are the forward implications of this ruling for Musk's compensation?
This ruling makes it very likely that Musk will give up a separate $23.7 billion interim compensation plan. That was designed to prevent him from double dipping while this 2018 fight was ongoing. And crucially, this decision does not affect his more recent 2025 pay package, which could top $1 trillion if Tesla hits an $8.5 trillion market cap. And that 2025 package was issued under Texas law, where Tesla re-domiciled last year, a jurisdiction that corporate attorneys believe will be far less hospitable to these kinds of shareholder lawsuits than Delaware.
Looking broadly at the markets, how did the indexes perform at the close of the week?
They showed some real strength on Friday. The S&P 500 advanced 0.9%, the Nasdaq surged 1.3%, and the Dow Industrials finished up 0.4%. And on top of that, the housing market saw a positive trend. Home sales rose in November for the third consecutive month, citing lower mortgage rates injecting some fresh momentum.
We have to talk about the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, because the latest report is based on some really sketchy data, thanks to the government shutdown. The critical insight here is that the inflation number you heard is probably unreliable, and this uncertainty is going to last for months.
That's the key takeaway. Forget the specific November inflation number. It's likely wrong, and this cloud of uncertainty will persist for about 6 months. Economists are warning that the accuracy of inflation figures is highly questionable because the November CPI data was clouded by sketchy data collection caused by that recent government shutdown.
How does 1 month of missing data create a systemic problem that lasts for half a year?
It's a technical detail. It's about how the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the BLS, operates. Housing costs, especially rent, make up about a third of the entire CPI basket. The BLS doesn't survey rents everywhere every single month. It rotates its sampling. Because the October CPI report was missed entirely, that missing rent data can linger and skew the figures for 6 full months as the agency struggles to estimate the actual housing costs for that rotational sample.
So the reported drop in November inflation could just be an illusion caused by the government's own stopgap measures.
That is the consensus among economists. The BLS, because they lacked solid October data, appears to have just penciled in a 0% increase for that crucial month, and that would artificially skew the November reported figures downward. They believe the Thursday report likely underestimated the true change in consumer prices, and we're going to feel the effects of this data lag well into the spring.
Another critical market development is the shock being felt in the world of non-traded funds. It's revealing this massive discrepancy between what managers said their assets were worth and what the market actually priced them at.
This gets to a core principle of finance. An asset is only worth what someone else is willing to pay for it, not what a manager writes on a piece of paper. Fund managers had long marketed private assets as this escape from public market volatility. They promised price stability. But recent public listings have brutally exposed the truth. Price stability cannot coexist with accessible liquidity.
Tell us about this discount shock.
Okay, the most vivid example is the BlueRock Private Real Estate Fund. It began trading on the NYSE with a stated net asset value, or NAV, of $24.36, but it closed at a market price of $14.70.
Wow, that is a staggering 39.7% discount.
It is. For every dollar the fund managers claimed the shares were worth, the public market offered only 60 cents. Another one, the FS Specialty Lending Fund, listed at a 25% discount to its NAV.
Wait a second here. If the manager stated NAV was almost 40% higher than what the market paid, that's not just a discount. That's almost a 40% internal valuation error. Is this really a complex financial dynamic, or is this just a case of managers actively misleading their investors about the value of their assets?
That is the critical question being raised right now. The managers were using these subjective internal valuations that just failed the test of real-world liquidity. When returns start to falter, investors demand to cash out at that stated and maybe fictional NAV. That can rapidly shrink the funds and destroy the manager's fees. So listing publicly is a form of self-defense for the managers, but it delivers a shocking, painful lesson to the investors. The stability they were promised was illusory the moment they actually wanted their money back.
We have several other key business and finance headlines to cover briefly, starting with a massive IPO.
The medical supplies distributor Medline made the biggest U.S. initial public offering of the year, raising over $6 billion. And the stock jumped 41% on its first day of trading. This bodes very well for market confidence and other large potential IPOs that are waiting in the wings, like Elon Musk's SpaceX.
And more legal drama for Tesla. This time about their technology messaging.
A California administrative law judge ordered Tesla to stop its autopilot messaging, finding that it deceived consumers by falsely implying its cars could drive on their own. The California DMV successfully argued that names like autopilot and full self-driving capability amounted to false advertising, suggesting capabilities the vehicle simply do not have. Tesla shares fell 4.6% on that news.
Meanwhile, the AI boom continues to fuel specific sectors like memory chips.
Right. This semiconductor maker, Micron Technology, posted a massive jump in revenue. It's due to ongoing shortages and just huge demand for its memory chips, which are essential for AI applications. The company raised its outlook and its shares surged 10%.
A fascinating and highly unconventional merger involving Trump Media.
Trump Media and Technology Group agreed to merge with a nuclear fusion company called TAE Technologies. It's an all-stock deal worth over $6 billion, and the explicit goal is to capitalize on the growing power requirements of the artificial intelligence boom. So they're merging Truth Social's parent company with a fusion technology firm. Trump Media shares jumped 42% on that announcement.
And lastly, the high drama of Hollywood mergers is in full swing.
Warner Bros. Discovery rejected a hostile bid from Paramount Skydance, reaffirming its planned $72 billion deal with Netflix. Netflix CEO Ted Sarandos is heavily involved. He's seeking an iconic studio property like Warner Bros. And its production lot. Sarandos has promised to keep movies in theaters, which signals a major strategic shift for the streaming giant, given his history of radical disruption. Separately, the activist investor Elliott Investment Management built a stake of over $1 billion in Lululemon, and they're advocating for former Ralph Lauren executive Jane Nielsen as the new CEO. And Sony will pay over $450 million to double its stake in Peanuts Holdings, confirming that Snoopy remains a very valuable global asset.
Shifting now from the financial markets to our own consumer habits, we have some interesting and pretty tangible economic indicators.
and they involve Christmas trees.
That's right. For years, Christmas tree sales have been a surprisingly accurate indicator of overall consumer spending, and the current survey suggests a very slow holiday season. Sales are running only 3% above last year's levels, which is a major slowdown compared to the 7% rise we saw the previous year.
What are the sellers observing on the ground that suggests this consumer caution?
They're reporting what they call a bifurcated economy. The high-end shoppers, they're spending freely. Trees costing $100 or more are doing very well. But the middle-class consumer is pulling back significantly. Sales of mid-range trees, around $75, and extras like wreaths and garlands, they're all down. The CEO of Balsam Brands, which sells artificial trees, noted that while his expensive artificial trees sold well, overall sales are down, with shoppers switching to smaller trees.
So it sounds like the U.S. consumer is hesitant. Does that sentiment track globally?
Not universally, no. One CEO noted that sales were up strongly in Canada, the UK, France, Germany, and Australia. And that contrasts with the U.S. consumer, who he says is concerned about the economy and more hesitant. This uncertainty is compounded by the fact that the government's key November retail sales report was delayed because of the shutdown, leaving us with this mixed picture from other data sources. Adobe said online sales were up strongly, but Bank of America suggested sales growth tapered off late in November.
That caution leads us perfectly into the psychology of online shopping. Why do we keep buying cheap garbage with suspiciously high ratings?
New research explains that this is a predictable cognitive bias that we all have. People are simply harsher critics of more expensive items. The psychological pain of spending more money actually factors into reviewers' opinions and drags the rating down. Conversely, the less we pay, the more generous our assessment tends to be.
So, high ratings on cheap items are often a result of lowered expectations or just the consumer feeling better about the low cost of the transaction.
Exactly. And this bias, combined with algorithms that favor cheaper, high-volume items with good ratings, steers consumers toward what amounts to a sea of mediocrity. We might miss out on potentially higher quality, marked-down products that received slightly lower ratings only because their original high cost anchored the reviewer's expectations higher.
So how do we as consumers combat this bias? How do we stop falling for the 4.5-star cheap product?
The key is becoming aware of it and engaging what psychologists call system 2 thinking. That's slow, deliberate thought. You have to factor in the cost difference. So for example, if you see an expensive high-end item on sale with a 4-star rating and a regularly cheap item with 4.5 stars, that 4-star expensive item is almost certainly higher quality. You have to read the reviews more critically and factor in the cost and the relative expectations.
And mobile shopping seems to accelerate this problem.
It does.
Yeah.
Mobile purchases now account for a record 56% of holiday sales. And shopping on our phones triggers that fast, emotional system one thinking. It's accelerated by mechanisms like Apple Pay and Buy Now, Pay Later options, which make it incredibly easy to complete that spontaneous, uncritical purchase.
From cheap impulse buys, we move to the extreme high end of the market, where Louis Vuitton is making a massive, risky bet on spectacle and experience. They're moving into something they call retailtainment.
Louis Vuitton is pushing beyond just selling products. They're creating massive, hyper-experiential sites that blend culture, food, and shopping. This strategy is being championed by their CEO, Pietro Beccari, and his mantra is explicit. Don't think big, think huge. As the industry's biggest brand by sales, they feel they have to lead this evolution.
And the most famous example of this radical strategy is the Louis, that massive ship to nowhere that's docked in Shanghai.
It's an incredible spectacle. The Louis is this steel vessel. It's longer than a football field, about 100 feet high, and it's permanently docked right on a prime Shanghai shopping street. It functions as part store, part museum. You need reservations to get in. And it successfully draws 100,000 visitors a day to the mall. It links Vuitton's heritage of travel with contemporary icons, so you can explore archival items and then buy a gold-finished trunk, all while sipping lattes with monogram foam art.
Is this just a one-off stunt, or is this a global strategy?
It's rapidly becoming global. They have other massive projects, like taking over a huge wing of South Korea's oldest department store in Seoul, and a grand new flagship in Paris, slated for 2027, that will incorporate a hotel and an art space. They're investing heavily in flagships on Fifth Avenue and Rodeo Drive that prioritize hospitality and experience over just traditional retail space.
It sounds like a bold bet at a time when luxury growth is fading and consumers are increasingly questioning the cost justification of these goods.
That is the essential risk. The overhead for these brand cathedrals is astronomical. It challenges the industry's traditionally high margins, which relied on these compact, exclusive boutiques. But Bekri is convinced that the experience itself is the draw, and it's designed to convert curious visitors into committed shoppers. He believes consumers should leave thinking, wow, I spent 2 hours with the brand and didn't even notice the time passing. They are essentially operating as an entertainment brand to draw in younger, more cautious consumers.
Now let's turn to some difficult domestic issues, starting with the intense anger in Los Angeles over the lack of accountability nearly a year after that devastating Pacific Palisades fire.
The lack of transparency has fueled extreme resentment among the residents who lost their homes. The new LAFD chief, Jamie Moore, he pledged transparency, but in a recent interview, he framed the fire as a blame-free fluke caused by Santa Ana winds and low rainfall. He was effectively implying that nothing could have been done to prevent it.
But the residents and subsequent reviews, they point to clear human and institutional errors.
Yes. The documentation reveals several critical errors. There was a delayed response. One resident who first called in the fire saw no fire trucks for at least 20 minutes, suggesting that early containment was possible. Second, there was a failure in pre-deployment. No extra trucks were sent to the Palisades, an area that was deemed extreme fire risk, because the pre-deployment matrix they used had inaccurate moisture readings. Firefighters were functionally handicapped by poor political leadership and municipal failures, like not clearing brush.
But the intense anger seems to be focused on the actions, or the lack of action, that was taken on day two of the fire.
Oh, absolutely. On day two, as mutual aid crews from surrounding cities arrived, the LAFD seemingly retreated. Residents in communities like Las Casas, where all but three houses were lost, they reported seeing not a single truck here, even as new fires were starting to break out. And the most damning evidence of this official silence is that the LAFD's own official after-action report abruptly ends on day one. It refuses to address the critical, catastrophic failures of that second day, which just reinforces this sense of an institutional, fraternal code of silence.
That lack of accountability is just devastating. Now, for a shift in focus, we have some interesting wisdom on modern parenthood from the former White House chief of staff and Chicago mayor, Rahm Emanuel.
Emanuel and his wife shared four guiding principles that they used to raise their three successful children, all of whom have gone into military or national security fields, which is a really powerful testimonial to their approach.
What's their first core principle?
First, meals matter. They insisted on eating together at least four nights a week. They used a circular table mirroring Emanuel's mother's tradition to ensure open debate and equal speaking rights. And crucially, they banned screens from the table. The table was the central place for communication.
I love that idea of enforced focus time. What was their second principle?
Presence over quantity. Emanuel insists the debate over quality versus quantity of time is bunk. What matters is being authentically present when you are there. His wife demanded he finish his phone calls on the porch so that when he walked in the door, his focus was immediately and completely on the children. They also made sure to take one-on-one trips and enforce time without TV or internet during the summer.
As a parent, banning screens for the summer sounds like a recipe for rebellion. How did they manage that level of demanding structure?
Well, it connects to their third principle, which is supportive and demanding. Parental love has to be the unconditional foundation, but setting low expectations, he argues, is not love at all. His parents used to post report cards on the fridge. He and his wife used a star plate on Shabbat for children who did something noteworthy. And that star plate came with the privilege of inviting a friend's family over, which allowed the parents to subtly observe the moral character of the friends their children were choosing. That's some real parental intelligence.
And the final principle focuses on interests and exposure.
Nurture interests and exposure. Parents should expose their kids to stimuli that expand their thinking, walking toddlers facing outward, visiting cultural attractions, and reading good old-fashioned books. The final wisdom Emanuel offers is simple and profound. Children are always watching, even when they aren't listening. Good parenting, he stresses, is a learned behavior.
That concept of awareness and the need for better data is also driving calls for major reform in how we regulate sophisticated wearable health technology.
Absolutely. Devices like the Oura Ring are now capable of delivering clinical-grade insights. They're acting as a personalized check engine light by providing continuous biometric readings. But federal policy just has not evolved to keep up. This sophisticated technology is stuck in a regulatory gray zone.
What exactly is that regulatory binary that's causing the problem?
Wearables fall into two outdated categories. They're either general wellness products, which have minimal oversight, or medical devices, which require a high burden for design, labeling, and a slow, costly FDA clearance process. These sophisticated devices fit poorly in this binary, forcing manufacturers to sacrifice key functionality just to avoid that slow, costly medical device clearance.
And what crucial functionality are we currently losing out on because of this regulatory gap?
With reformed regulation, these devices could already be screening for high blood pressure, which is a major risk factor for heart disease, stroke, and preeclampsia in pregnancy, as well as sophisticated sleep apnea detection, a condition that often goes undiagnosed and has severe long-term consequences.
So what's the proposed solution to unlock this functionality?
Experts are calling for a new classification, digital health screeners. These would be software features that warn users of trouble, you know, saying, "Your blood pressure is consistently high," but they would specifically stop short of an official diagnosis. This new classification would offer clear guidelines, explicit disclaimers about their non-diagnostic intent, and critically, performance standards for accuracy. This is reform the FDA can potentially enact on its own, and it would advance a much more proactive, personalized healthcare system.
Finally, let's wrap up with the high drama and chaos of college football, starting with Ole Miss. They're preparing for the college football playoff under some bizarre and conflicted circumstances.
It is peak college football drama. Ole Miss is preparing for the playoff after their former flamboyant coach, Lane Kiffin, abruptly left for LSU, burning every single bridge on his way out. The defensive coordinator, Pete Golding, was immediately promoted to replace him, inheriting a very high-pressure situation.
And Golding's job wasn't really coaching. It was essentially holding the entire program together with duct tape.
He described his first order of business as duct taping the rebels back together. He was desperately trying to keep recruits and players from transferring in the chaos. The situation was complicated immensely when the entire offensive staff initially bolted, including the offensive coordinator Charlie Weiss Jr. Golding had to work out a deal with LSU to convince Weiss and four other offensive assistants to return just for the postseason. It avoided a total nightmare scenario for their quarterback, Trinidad Chambliss.
So Kiffin torches the program on his way out, the entire offensive staff walks, and the new guy, Golding, has to duct tape a playoff team together, all while the fans know that if they win, Kiffin gets a massive bonus. That's just peak college football financial and moral drama.
That is the crushing irony. LSU agreed to honor Kiffin's previous bonus structure, which means the better Ole Miss does in the playoff, the more money Kiffin makes from the program he just abandoned. Golding, who's managing this impossible task, the job he had long aspired to, simply said he is doing it by not sleeping.
And on the subject of strategy and subterfuge, the Miami Hurricanes coach, Mario Cristobal, seems to have turned secrecy into his signature style, weaponizing the lack of information.
Cristobal is notorious for his extreme secrecy, his stealth, and his subterfuge. He famously repeats his philosophy, "We're in the information-gathering business, not the information-giving business." He views any piece of public data as unnecessary value given to the opponent.
And this extended to erasing public roster data, specifically the players' weights.
Yes. For an entire summer, Miami was the only Power Four conference team that didn't list player weights online. The data just vanished between February and April. And this was significant enough that the staff of number 6 Notre Dame, who Miami upset in the season opener to earn their playoff berth, they quietly noticed the omission and attempted their own reconnaissance, combing the internet for player interviews where they might have discussed weight changes.
That's a huge operational commitment by Notre Dame just for a piece of public roster data.
It just underscores the lengths Cristobal will go to for a perceived competitive advantage. He's a veteran recruiter who previously closed Oregon's indoor practice facility even to the track and field team. He refused to publicly name starters ahead of the 2020 season. And interestingly, after a reporter inquired about the phantom weights, they quietly reappeared on the website without any comment.
The sheer volume of material we've covered today is truly staggering. It cuts across everything from, you know, football subterfuge and that massive Musk pay package decision to complex non-traditional diplomacy in Russia and that ambitious but maybe unrealistic vision for Gaza.
We've seen these clear themes of high stakes, unconventional deal making, whether it's Steve Witkoff bypassing the CIA or pharmaceutical companies trading price cuts for tariff protection. We also see these critical, costly failures in transparency, from the heavily redacted Epstein files to the lack of accountability after the devastating Palisades fire, and even the intentional clouding of key economic data like the CPI.
This deep dive was designed to cut through that information overload and provide some real clarity on these major developments to help you understand the complex, dynamic forces that are shaping policy, markets, and culture right now.
And as we close, let's leave you with a provocative thought that kind of links all these disparate stories we've covered, from the courts, to the field, to the negotiating table. When institutions or leaders prioritize personal control or expediency or exclusive deal-making over an open process, whether it's the Pentagon bypassing acquisitions or fund managers creating subjective valuations or a coach hiding his team's data, what is the ultimate price paid by the public, the shareholders, or the followers for that lack of transparency? Something for you to mull over until our next deep dive.
Cheers, see you next time.